And I've been really enjoying studying the lives of some of these Old Testament people. And because we know that these stories, they're not just an historical account. There's so much we can learn about God and about how we should live in the stories themselves. Not that we live in the same culture or, you know, there'll be lots of differences, but there are many, many themes that come through that are for our growth and development too. So over the last couple of years, I've told you a few stories about some heroes of the Bible who aren't named. We're not told much about them, but they're fascinating characters. And this woman from Shunem is one of the unnamed heroes of the Bible. But it gets a bit clunky talking about somebody without a name, especially for 20 minutes or so. So let's call her Shulam, which is a feminine form of Solomon and rhymes with Shunem. So that's a good name. I know we read the story, but we'll go through it step by step and try and pick it apart a bit. And Bron is going to try very hard to follow the slides because we can't find Chris's clicker. He's got it with him. Oh, that's a great help. Anyway, thank you, Bron. So one day, Elisha went to the town of Shunem. A wealthy woman lived there and she urged him to come to her home for a meal, as we might do sometimes. I've often done that at church too, ask visitors to come home for a meal. After that, whenever he passed that way, he would stop there for something to eat. One day she said to her husband, "I'm sure this man who stops in from time to time is a holy man of God. Let's build a small room for him on the roof and furnish it with a bed and a table and a chair and a lamp, make it comfortable. Then he'll have a place to stay whenever he comes by." So the first thing we learn about Shulam is that she was wealthy and married, two circumstances that placed her in quite a privileged, comfortable position in her society. Elisha's position as a spiritual leader and teacher required regular travel, and he became acquainted with Shulam and her husband whenever he passed through Shunem. Neither sought the friendship to boost their respective positions in society or to boast of the important people they knew. Elisha just shared God's love and truth with rich and poor alike, and Shulam initiated the relationship because she was caring and hospitable. But having got to know each other a little bit first, at their first meal together, the couple's home in Shunem became a welcome haven for Elisha. Shulam came to realise that Elisha was a distinguished prophet. Apparently he was a humble man who didn't feel the need to let everybody know how important he was, and being a godly person herself, Shulam recognised Elisha's close relationship with God. She suggested to her husband that they make a permanent place for Elisha to stop over so they could offer him a service and learn from him and be blessed by getting to know him better and learning from him. Shulam was thoughtful, hospitable, generous and committed to supporting Elisha. She was also humble and considerate of her husband's needs. Apparently she could afford to add another room to her home, but she ensured that she discussed it with her husband first and included him in her plans. Some commentators think that she was the one with all the money. And she sets us a good example then by discussing major expenses with her husband before committing to anything. So one day Elisha returned to Shunem and he went up to this upper room to rest. He said to his servant Gehazi, "Tell the woman from Shunem I want to speak to her." When she appeared, Elisha said to Gehazi, "Tell her we appreciate the kind concern you've shown us. What can we do for you? Can we put in a good word for you to the king or to the commander of the army?" "No," she replied, "my family takes good care of me." Elisha was very grateful for the sanctuary that Shulam had provided for him and his servant Gehazi, but he felt he couldn't accept it without giving something in return to show his appreciation. But he couldn't think of anything to give or do for her, so he asked her directly. Since he had influence with King Joram, who was the king of Israel at that time, he even offered to advocate for positions of honour at court or with the army commander for safety and protection of the family's wealth. But another blank. Financially, politically, socially, she had everything she needed. For some people, no amount of money or power is enough. But this lady was satisfied. Paul was able to say that he never felt in need because he'd learnt how to be content with whatever he had. Contentment is one of the most fulfilling gifts we can have. Shulam's life wasn't perfect, but she was content. And then Gehazi had an idea. Later, Elisha asked Gehazi, "What can we do for her?" And Gehazi replied, "She doesn't have a son and her husband is an old man." "Call her back again," Elisha told him. And when Shulam returned, Elisha said to her as she stood in the doorway, "Next year at this time you'll be holding a son in your arms." "No, my lord," she cried, "O man of God, don't deceive me and get my hopes up like that." But sure enough, the woman soon became pregnant, and at that time, the following year, she had a son, just as Elisha had said. Culturally, in biblical times, childlessness was shameful. Shulam loved the Lord and she was generally at peace with her situation, but like most of us would, she still harboured a deep longing for a child. God had miraculously given sons to several couples who'd been able to have children, like Sarah and Abraham, Rachel and Isaac, Hannah and Elkanah, and Samson's parents. And even though Shulam probably knew all those stories, she dared not hope that she would be blessed with such a miracle. I'm sure she saw herself as just an ordinary person in an ordinary town, just doing ordinary life. Yet within a year, she'd given birth to a little boy. But one day, when the child was older, he went out to help his father, who was working with the harvesters. Suddenly he cried out, "My head hurts, my head hurts." His father said to one of his servants, "Carry him home to his mother." So the servant took him home, and his mother held him on her lap. But around noontime, he died. She carried him up and laid him on the bed of the man of God and then shut the door and left him there. She sent a message to her husband, "Send one of your servants and a donkey so that I can hurry to the man of God and come right back." "Why go today?" he asked. "It's not New Moon Festival nor a Sabbath." But she said, "It'll be all right." So she saddled the donkey and said to the servant, "Hurry, don't slow down unless I tell you." A few years had passed. The baby boy was old enough to go out with his father on the farm, but still small enough to sit in his mother's lap. He could be anything up to 9 or 10, I suppose, depending on how big he was. Then one day, tragedy struck. Out of the blue, the boy was hit with excruciating pain in his head, and within a couple of hours, he was dead. Apparently his father didn't suspect anything too serious because he asked a servant to take him to the home rather than taking him himself. And it was too early in the morning for it to be heat stroke, so there was no reason to suppose that his son's life was about to be snatched away. Life is often a mystery. Hopes are dashed, fortunes suddenly change, loved ones unexpectedly gone. Trauma, shock, grief, they all assault us at some stage. It can seem that God has abandoned us and betrayed us even. In shock, Shulam had only one thought on her mind, to get to Elisha. This bereaved mother's reaction will seem strange to some people, I'm sure. How could she remain so calm? Why was she not overcome with grief? But shock does different things to different people. There are no right and wrong ways to respond when our mind is battered by a sudden trauma. And there's certainly no gain in judging others for their reactions. I think that as her son lay dying in her arms, she was pleading with God to save him. And then the thought came to her that Elisha could help. Elisha had been their spiritual leader for several years now. Her son was the answer to Elisha's prayers in the first place. Maybe God would listen to Elisha again. Shulam appears to have been a mature, stable, calm personality. In her shock and grief, her natural tendency was probably to withdraw into herself and just do what she needed to do. But when it was obvious that her son was gone, she laid him on Elisha's bed. Symbolically, she placed him in the arms of Elisha's God and raced to find Elisha. Anger and blame towards God would have been emotionally crippling at that point, and Shulam showed no sign of being distracted from her mission by such thoughts. Rather, her faith focused her mind and carried her until she found Elisha. The past is usually a good predictor of the future. God had blessed her in the past. Now she trusted that he would bless her again. Shulam's faith was certainly put to the test that day. Not only was her child dead, but Elisha was miles away just when she needed him most. Like our muscles, though, faith strengthens most when it is put under strain. Faith that carries us through the worst times in life is worth more than any riches. Shulam had probably heard how Elijah had raised the Zarephath widow's son back to life. She also knew that God's spirit was with Elisha now in the same way that he'd been with Elijah. The only sensible thing to do was go immediately to Elisha. Faith in God's power and goodness inspired Shulam's actions. We know this because she's mentioned in the New Testament. Some of the achievements which God's people made through faith in the Old Testament are listed in Hebrews chapter 11. You're probably familiar with that one. And one of them, among them, is this one. Women received their loved ones back again from death. Only two women saw their loved ones raised from the dead, and the great woman of Shunem is one of them. But let's think about the way Shulam treated her husband for a minute. She sent a message to her husband, "Send one of the servants and a donkey so that I can hurry to the man of God and come right back." "Why go today?" he asked. "It's neither a new moon festival nor a Sabbath," but she said it'll be all right. She couldn't explain it all right then, but she told him what she intended to do and she asked for a servant and a donkey. She didn't just rush off and leave a hastily scrawled note that he probably wouldn't find till that evening. Faith is bold and courageous, but it's never inconsiderate or rude. Shulam's husband was mystified at his wife's urgent desire to see Elisha. No religious event requiring Elisha's presence or their attendance was coming up, but he trusted her judgment. She would tell him what was happening in good time. Shulam could have been put off by her husband's question. Many of us doubt ourselves when our plans are questioned, especially by our family and friends. But faith must not expect the path to be smooth and easy. One of Satan's most effective tactics is to undermine our faith through opposition from our loved ones. He's achieved quite a victory if he can trap us into abandoning our godly plans because of doubt or fear. "It will be all right," the grieving mother replied. There was no time to try to put into words the horrible loss and shock. She had to get to Elisha. Things were not all right yet, but she believed they would be. Her child was dead, but still the reality and strength of her faith shined through her firm, unshaken confidence. So Shulam mounted the donkey and made the arduous journey to Mount Carmel. Her own comfort was irrelevant. Love for her son overrode the hardships. "Hurry, don't slow down unless I tell you," she said to the servant. The journey was actually about 40 kilometres, 25 miles, about the distance of a marathon. On the back of a donkey, that might have been a bit of a rugged day. But love and faith drove her. Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. That's pretty amazing that you've just been there. Yeah, that's great. While our faith is merely an intellectual exercise, it achieves nothing. Faith grows most during times of stress and trouble. That's when we are the most motivated to depend on God, and our faith, his power and love. So as she approached the man of God at Mount Carmel, Elisha saw her in the distance and he said to Gehazi, "Look, the woman from Shunem is coming. Run out to meet her and ask her, 'Is everything all right with you, with your husband and with your child?'" "Yes," the woman told Gehazi, "everything is fine." But when she came to the man of God at the mountain, she fell to the ground before him and caught hold of his feet. Gehazi began to push her away, but the man of God said, "Leave her alone. She's deeply troubled, but the Lord has not told me what it is." Then she said, "Did I ask you for a son, my Lord? Didn't I say, 'Don't deceive me and get my hopes up'?" Then Elisha said to Gehazi, "Get ready to travel. Take my staff and go. Don't talk to anyone along the way. Go quickly and lay the staff on the child's face." But the boy's mother said, "As surely as the Lord lives and you yourself live, I won't go home unless you go with me." So Elisha returned with her. Now, prophets such as Elijah and Elisha moved around Israel and frequently visited Mount Carmel. Mount Carmel was the place where God, through Elijah, had so dramatically proved his supremacy, his power and judgment on evil. Being on a mountain suggests wanting to be near God, and God often revealed himself to his people on mountains. The work of a prophet was spiritually and emotionally draining. Elisha regularly needed to spend time with God in a place that vividly reminded him of God's power. But from his vantage point, so if it's so big, Graham, I wonder how he, how she found him. That's tricky. Yeah. But from his vantage point, so he was obviously up the mountain a bit, he saw her approaching and he guessed immediately that this was no social visit. I don't know why Elisha sent Gehazi ahead to meet Shulam instead of rushing to meet her himself. Perhaps Gehazi could run faster. It seems it was customary to send a servant to make initial inquiries, and Elisha does seem to be the sort of person who liked to follow protocol. So Gehazi gets to her and everything is fine, she says. Of course, everything was not fine, but Shulam knew that no servant could make a difference to her crisis. She needed to speak to the prophet himself. She hung on to hope and faith that God would work through Elisha. Shulam scrambled up the mountain track with her eyes fixed on Elisha. Her emotions were firmly bottled until she reached the prophet she had come to know and respect. Gehazi was clueless. The woman had told him everything was fine, so why was she now throwing himself at Elisha's feet? Officiously, he started to pull Shulam away. But how callous! This is the woman who had shown him and Elisha so much hospitality. When Elisha wanted to show his gratitude, Gehazi himself had pointed out to Elisha that she had no children. Again, Shulam's faith was tested by opposition from someone who should have shown more compassion. Elisha at least sensed that something was wrong. The grieving mother's reminder that she hadn't asked for a child, that she'd been content with to accept childlessness, that Elisha himself had asked God to give her the child, that galvanised him into action. And his first action was to send Gehazi running ahead. Gehazi was not to stop to talk to anybody along the way, and he was to lay Elisha's staff on the boy's body. Now, this is all rather strange. And through the centuries, Bible students have struggled to understand why Elisha sent Gehazi instead of going immediately himself. In fact, in all the commentaries, it seems to be quite a point of contention. They seem to want to make out that somebody was wrong in this situation. They've questioned, was Elisha being lazy by delegating his duty to Gehazi, a servant? Or was he floundering around not knowing what to do, so he picked on sending Gehazi? Did Elisha actually believe his staff had some sort of magical power? Was he arrogant enough to think that sending his servant and staff was acceptable? Was he ignorant of Gehazi's questionable character? Had he not noticed that Gehazi had just tried to push Shulam away? Should Shulam have prayed directly to God instead of going to Elisha? All these questions come up. I'm not sure that anyone did anything wrong in this scenario, but here's my best understanding. Elisha's habit was to send Gehazi on ahead of himself. He asked Gehazi to ask Shulam the question in the very first place, what he could do for him instead of asking him himself, even though she was standing there. But it seemed to be some sort of protocol. Gehazi may well have been younger and faster, but this just seemed to be the way Elisha operated. Gehazi carried Elisha's staff of office and authority. No one would touch the boy while Elisha's staff laid on the body. So that would give Elisha and Shulam time to get back to the home. Naturally, Shulam reached out to someone who could support her in her distress. She knew Elisha had a very close relationship with God. It had been Elisha's prayer that had been answered to give birth to her son. To me, it seems entirely appropriate that she would go to Elisha for help when the miracle child died. God is always working in our lives to grow our knowledge and faith in him. Elisha, Gehazi, and Shulam were the main players in a dramatic real-life lesson about God's power and love. And the disaster itself was inexplicable for two reasons. First, God had given the boy to Shulam because of the kindness she'd shown his servant Elisha. Now it looked as though God was being most unkind to her. Second, the boy's birth was a miracle, yet now the miracle had been cancelled. As Gehazi prepared to leave, it appeared that Elisha did not intend to go himself to the family's home. For a moment, Shulam's faith was tested again. "As surely as the Lord lives and you yourself live, I won't go home unless you go with me," she said to Elisha. She had no confidence in Gehazi or Elisha's staff, rightly so. Her faith was in the living God, and she had confidence that he would work through Elisha. So Gehazi hurried on ahead and laid the staff on the child's face, but nothing happened. There was no sign of life. He returned to meet Elisha and told him, "The child is still dead." When Elisha arrived, the child was indeed dead, lying there on the prophet's bed. So we've talked a bit about the mother's faith, but we should not overlook Elisha's faith. This was no ordinary, everyday situation. Who would have expected the miracle child to die? No doubt Elisha had a special bond with the boy. His loss was painful and bewildering. What was God's purpose in all of this? Still, Elisha refused to accept the boy's death as final. Though he had never faced such a desperate situation before, Elisha knew that with God everything is possible. When Shulam placed her dead child on Elisha's bed, she unknowingly challenged Elisha's faith. He would not fail to appeal to God. Faith doesn't demand that God do what we want him to do, but it does expect God to do something. In faith, Elisha rushed back to Shunem to see what God would do. He went in alone and shut the door and prayed to the Lord. Then he lay down on the child's body, placing his mouth on the child's mouth, his eyes on the child's eyes, and his hands on the child's hands. And as he stretched out on him, the child's body began to grow warm again. Elisha got up, walked back and forth across the room, and then stretched himself out again on the child. Sometimes we need to be alone with God. Elisha had no idea what God would do, and at that point, the matter was between him and God. Elisha needed to express his own helplessness and total dependence on the Lord. Elisha was convinced that nothing is too hard for God, and therefore no request is too large to present to him. In fact, the more we appeal to God's infinite power and grace, the more he is honoured. Just as Elijah had done for the widow of Zarephath's son, Elisha laid his own warm body on the cold, still body of the boy. He deeply felt Shulam's anguish and identified with her intense longing for the boy to live again. Symbolically, he stretched the problem out before God and transferred his own warmth and life to the boy. Elisha's actions illustrate how we should pray for others who are in deep distress, with compassion for their pain, some understanding of the trauma of their situation, and a genuine longing for God's help. We lay the problem out before the Lord. God didn't answer Elisha's prayer for the dead boy immediately. Some warmth returned to his body, but more was needed. Standing up, stretching, or walking seems to help us calm emotions and focus our thoughts, so that's what Elisha did. He walked across the room as he prayed. Now, Andrew has often said that God isn't a vending machine. We don't plug in our prayers and expect the right answers to pop out. Different situations will be resolved in different ways. Many take time for events to play out, for attitudes to change, for trust to be rebuilt. Often God asks us to be patient and persistent. Perseverance, tenacity, determination, these are all valuable character traits which he loves to help us develop, and they only develop through the tough times. That's probably why God didn't restore the boy's life all at once. Elisha needed to learn to stick with God through to the end. God had not promised either Elisha or the Shunammite mother that the child would come back to life. They couldn't pray as you have promised, like David sometimes prayed when he said, "Lord, sustain me as you have promised that I may live. Do not let my hope be crushed." So for the grounds of his prayer, Elisha relied on the known character of God. Since God had given the child unasked, Elisha did not believe that God would now take away his gift and leave Shulam worse off than before. God has promised us that those who trust in the Lord will lack no good thing, that he never changes or casts a shifting shadow. God is merciful, so we can pray, "Have mercy on me, O God, because of your unfailing love." These are characteristics of God that give us confidence to trust him when we can't see the way forward. The warming body hinted that God was going to restore the boy's life. Elisha seized on that and laid his own body over the boy's once more. And this time the boy sneezed 7 times and opened his eyes. Picture Elisha's excitement. The Bible stories aren't told with a lot of emotion, but the great heroes were people just like us. It's not hard to imagine that Elisha was overwhelmed with happiness and relief as the boy sneezed and opened his eyes. There's an intriguing illustration of the change process here too. First, the boy's body warmed. Change rarely happens all at once. Our salvation is usually a process over time. There'll be a warming to the idea, a willingness to change, an interest in God. And then the boy sneezed. Sneezing clears the head, a metaphor for gaining understanding. Change takes place when we begin to understand what needs to be different. The Bible starts to make sense, and we become aware that God is real, and we hear his call to turn to him. Finally, the boy opened his eyes. Sight was restored, and with sight, his life returned. When we open our eyes to Jesus, we see spiritual truths clearly. Then our new life begins. So then Elisha summoned Gehazi. "Call the child's mother," he said. And when she came in, Elisha said, "Here, take your son." She fell at his feet and bowed before him, overwhelmed with gratitude. Then she took her son in her arms and carried him downstairs. And what a wonderful task for Gehazi, to call the boy's mother and see her overwhelming joy and love and gratitude. What an amazing woman the Shunammite mother was. Her son was sitting up in bed, but her first reaction was to give thanks to God and Elisha. Then she picked up her son and took him somewhere private, I'm sure, where she could smother him with love and pour out her gratitude to God. So, in conclusion, God miraculously gave Shulam a blessing and then apparently snatched it away, as though mocking her. But we know God is not like that. That would be wrong, and we know that God never does the wrong thing. If we expect God to protect us from sadness and trouble in this life, our hopes will certainly be dashed. Bad things happen because evil still exists, and Satan loves to take advantage of our calamities and our tragedies to persuade us that God is not good, that he doesn't love us, and that he's abandoned us. But the woman from Shunem, was not deceived. She recognized her son's death as a test of her faith. She lovingly placed her son's body on Elisha's bed, knowing that this was not a time to give in to grief and despair. As quickly as she could, she went to Elisha, who had promised her the son in the first place. She wasn't deterred by her husband's questions or Gehazi's meanness. She pushed through the pain of riding the distance of a marathon on a donkey. To her, Elisha was God's representative, and he would surely plead her case before God, who had given her the son. Elisha's faith also came under attack. He was enjoying time with God on the mountain, perhaps reflecting on God's goodness when the terrible news arrived. The shock was great, and Elisha was a little slow to realize that the only thing to do was to go with Shulam to her son. His role was usually leadership, but this situation called for him to do the front line work. Once he understood, though, he didn't hesitate. There are lots of points in this story that might resonate with you today and that God might challenge or encourage you with, but perhaps I can summarize the lessons like this. Prayer is always the first strategy to use. Then we must take action. The great woman of Shunem raced a marathon to reach Elisha. She did not give up, even though her faith was questioned and tested. Elisha threw himself into the task, heart and soul, and he didn't give up until the answer was clear. Some older translations call this woman the Great Woman of Shunem, which is why I've titled it the way I did. Modern translations seem to focus on the wealthy bit. But she was great in lots of other ways too. She was great in hospitality and thoughtfulness, even adding a room onto her house for Elisha to use as a place of respite. Maybe it was easier to add rooms to your house back then. It probably wasn't all that cheap neither. It seems to me that that was a pretty big effort to go to for a prophet. She was great in maturity, accepting her childlessness and finding contentment in the good things that she did have in life. She was great spiritually, showing such a depth of faith when tragedy struck. David wrote, "The godly people in the land are my true heroes. I take pleasure in them." The woman from Shunem is certainly an inspiring figure, one of the unnamed heroes of the Bible. And let's just pray as we come to the end here. Lord, we thank you for the example of the great woman of Shunem and Elisha. She was just an ordinary woman like us. And yet you used her and worked in her life in an extraordinary way. Thank you for everything that we can learn through this simple story in your word. May we remember to pray, that prayer is our first defense against fear and temptation. May we always remember to turn to you first before we start looking for our own answers. May we have faith that trusts in you even when disaster strikes. May we have faith that perseveres until the answer is clear. And may we have faith that remembers that you are good, that you do love us, and that you will never abandon us. Amen. Thank you.